In a world increasingly defined by polarization and uncertainty, Jordan Peterson's Beyond Order arrives as both counterpoint and complement to his previous bestseller. While his first book emphasized the importance of order in a chaotic world, this sequel explores the opposite danger, too much rigidity and control. As Elon Musk noted, Peterson's work helped me through some dark times, joining millions who have found Peterson's blend of psychology, mythology, and practical wisdom transformative. Since its 2021 release, the book has been translated into over 50 languages and spent months on bestseller lists worldwide. What makes Peterson's approach so compelling is his ability to weave ancient wisdom with modern science, creating a roadmap for those seeking meaning in an increasingly complex world. We often underestimate how deeply our mental health depends on social connections. Peterson illustrates this through a client who lived in extreme isolation, with minimal family ties and a history of abuse and bullying. Over a decade of therapy, this man gradually rebuilt his life by cultivating friendships and reviving his musical talents. Through this case, Peterson reveals a profound truth. Sanity isn't merely an individual achievement, but a collective enterprise. While Freud and Jung viewed mental health as primarily about integrating subpersonalities within the individual mind, Peterson argues they underestimated community's role in maintaining psychological stability. We outsource our sanity to others who constantly provide subtle corrections through reactions and cues. When assessing new clients, Peterson evaluates them along social dimensions: education, meaningful use of free time, future plans, economic stability, friendships, intimate partnerships, family relationships, and career satisfaction. Those lacking three or more of these connections risk psychological deterioration. Even something as simple as a toddler pointing at objects represents this fundamental social reality. When Peterson's granddaughter pointed at things and people responded, it validated both what she found important and her status as a respected center of consciousness. Pointing precedes language. To name something is essentially to point to it, specifying it against everything else. This process is inherently social. She would look around to see if others cared about what interested her, learning that communication has value only when it engages others. Our social hierarchies evolved over millions of years, with internal neural hierarchies mirroring external social organization. Through play with others, children establish shared goals and rules, creating microcosms that reflect principles of fair societies. The universal rules of fair play, emotional regulation, and reciprocally beneficial interactions across time form a meta-ethic across all games of life. The best player isn't necessarily who wins any single game, but who is invited to play the most games by others. This explains why we should hesitate before carelessly dismantling social institutions. These structures have evolved to solve problems essential for life's continuation. Though imperfect, improving rather than destroying them requires careful consideration. The conservative and creative attitudes perpetuate themselves because both approaches have merit. Doing what others have done often works, while radical action can sometimes produce extraordinary success. Who are you, and who could you become? This question lies at the heart of human development. We are complex beyond our own understanding, with our potential often obscured by poor health, misfortune, or unwillingness to seize life's opportunities. For guidance on who we might become, we can look to the distilled wisdom of shamans, prophets, artists, and storytellers who have observed human behavior for millennia. The most compelling stories present us with the ultimate adventure, divine romance, and eternal battle between good and evil, clarifying our understanding of moral action. These aren't mere entertainment, but templates for human transformation. Consider the ancient Mesopotamian Enuma Elish, where the hero god Marduk defeats the chaos monster Tiamat. This story brilliantly illustrates monotheism emerging from polytheism, as Marduk represents the highest values: careful attention, effective language, and courage to confront chaos. This hero pattern repeats across cultures and eras: Saint George rescuing the princess from the dragon, St. Patrick Chasing Snakes from Ireland, modern superhero films. These stories reflect humanity's evolutionary discovery that courage and vision can overcome predatory threats. As our capacity for abstraction grew, we recognized that monsters come in many forms beyond the purely animal. The greatest storytellers distill the most vital human actions into memorable narratives containing the deepest wisdom of mankind, embodied in the metahero who exists in the battleground between chaos and order. This hero pattern represents the highest god, mediating between opposing forces and transforming chaos into habitable order. Everyone needs such stories to structure their perceptions, providing a starting place and better ending place that gives meaning to life. To live meaningfully, we must aim at something noble, map our path accurately through past, present, and future, and be willing to correct course when necessary while avoiding mere capitulation to difficulty. You will zigzag forward, turning incrementally across time to aim more accurately at the highest value you can conceive. With discipline and transformation, you may find a meaningful story where you are the hero, benefiting both yourself and society. Peterson's father-in-law, an emotionally stable 88-year-old who had cared for his dementia-stricken wife with uncomplaining devotion, once snapped after 20 years of silently enduring bread-and-butter plates for lunch. This seemingly trivial complaint reveals an important truth. If something happens daily, it matters. Allowing minor irritations to continue unaddressed creates cumulative misery. Life consists of what repeats, and it's worth getting those repeating elements right rather than pretending to be satisfied with chronic irritations. Similarly, Peterson describes a client whose unhappy marriage stemmed from never confronting her husband about their home furnishings, which reflected only his preferences. With each silent concession, the next confrontation became both more necessary and less likely. These weren't mere objects, but containers of information about their marriage, each representing an unspoken defeat in a decades-long war. After 30 years, they divorced. Every small problem in a relationship will repeat across thousands of days unless addressed. The fog represents our refusal to notice and communicate our emotions and motivations, both to ourselves and to those close to us. When we're afraid of ourselves, others, and the world, we avoid knowing what we want, because knowing means hoping, and our hopes have been dashed before. We fear discovering there's nothing worth wanting, defining failure too clearly, or confirming our own culpability. This fog manifests as emotional opacity, where we refuse to articulate feelings that have accumulated without expression. We may even test others through sharp, insulting remarks when they come close to painful truths, simultaneously pushing them away and feeling disappointed when our defenses succeed. But this strategy exacts a terrible price: purposelessness, anxiety, and the inability to learn from failure. Without making clear what we want, we cannot hit targets we refuse to see. Experience contains latent information, like gold in ore, requiring extraction and refinement, often collaboratively, before it can improve our present and future. Extracting useful information from experience demands pure motivations and willingness to confront error. The world contains hidden dangers and opportunities. Refusing to see them won't help when fate forces you to run headlong through what you've ignored. To become invaluable in any workplace or community, do the useful things no one else is doing. Arrive earlier and leave later than others. Organize what's disorganized. Work genuinely rather than appearing busy. And learn more about the business than required. This makes you a linchpin. Start by solving small problems you can handle, then build yourself into someone who can tackle larger ones. By taking on excess responsibility, you position yourself to negotiate for what you need by demonstrating your value. The meaning that most effectively sustains life comes from adopting responsibility. There's a paradoxical relationship between difficulty and worth, as we voluntarily accept limitations to create meaningful structure, just as games require rules to function. The idea that life is suffering appears across religious traditions. The Sanskrit term for suffering, dukkha, relates to a misaligned wheel hole causing a bumpy ride, similar to the Greek hamartia, missing the mark. People often suffer not from active mistakes, but from passivity, failing to aim at anything specific. Without sacrificing potential for something real, one experiences all life's suffering with none of its meaning, a perfect description of hell. Even pure self-interest requires us to consider which self we're serving. Are we only caring for the self that exists this minute, or accounting for our future selves? Maximizing present pleasure at the expense of future well-being isn't truly in our interest. The human discovery of the future brings with it the necessity of work, sacrificing present delights for potential improvement of what lies ahead. While happiness is desirable, we shouldn't pursue it directly. Happiness is a right-now thing that makes us present-focused and impulsive, which conflicts with our need to optimize across time. The most reliable source of positive emotion isn't attainment, but the pursuit of valuable goals. When we implement a strategy toward a meaningful aim and see it working, we experience sustained positive emotion. This suggests a profound truth. There can be no happiness without responsibility. Our life becomes meaningful in proportion to the responsibility we shoulder. When we aim high enough, like a bricklayer seeing his work as part of a cathedral glorifying the highest good, even mundane tasks partake of the divine. The sense of meaning emerges when all our complexity aligns towards something worth pursuing, something that produces harmony. In corporate environments, we often encounter absurd manifestations of pathological order. Peterson describes a client embroiled in lengthy corporate discussions about whether the term flip chart was potentially offensive because flip was once a slur for Filipinos, despite no complaints from Filipino employees. The corporation eventually mandated easel pad as a replacement, sparking a contest to identify other potentially offensive terms. Being forced to participate in activities we find stupid or hateful is profoundly demoralizing because it violates our fundamental values. As Shakespeare wrote in Hamlet, "To thine own self be true." Acting against our core beliefs is to run our ship onto the shoals of destruction, to betray ourselves and suffer the inevitable emptiness that follows. When culture disintegrates because it refuses to acknowledge its own pathology or lacks visionary heroes, it descends into chaos. In such times, individuals must dive voluntarily into the depths to rediscover eternal principles that renew vision and life. The alternative is despair, corruption, and nihilism, becoming a miserable, lying slave to totalitarian utopianism. Even if you see yourself as merely a cog in a great enterprise, you must refuse to do what you hate. You must fortify your position regardless of its seeming insignificance, confront organizational mendacity, face the ensuing chaos, and live truthfully. Otherwise, you remain a marionette with strings pulled by demonic forces, and it's your fault. It's not about hating menial tasks or resenting low-status positions. Necessary work, like emptying garbage cans or cleaning bathrooms, is not what Peterson refers to. Resentment of such tasks often stems from ingratitude or arrogance. The true rejection of conscience is being forced to perform counterproductive or pointless work, to treat others unjustly, to engage in deceit, or to silently witness abuse. It's turning a blind eye and betraying your deepest values. The road to personal and social hell is paved with actions that disturb your conscience. After publishing his previous book, Peterson embarked on an extensive speaking tour, encountering massive audiences throughout the English-speaking world and Northern Europe. He was struck by what consistently brought every audience to dead silence: responsibility. Despite society's fundamental purpose of inculcating responsibility, something has gone wrong. We've spent too much time clamoring about rights and not asking enough of young people, leaving them vulnerable to easy answers and resentment. In the late 19th century, Friedrich Nietzsche famously announced, "God is dead," not triumphantly, but in absolute despair. He prophesied two major consequences: an existentially devastating rise in nihilism and people turning to rigid totalitarian ideology as a substitute for transcendent meaning. Dostoevsky addressed the same concerns in The Possessed, foreseeing how utopian ideology would present a danger exceeding all previous religious or monarchical brutality. Ideologies function by hyper-simplifying complex realities. The ideologue selects a few abstractions, the economy, the patriarchy, the environment, that mask extraordinary diversity and complexity. Take poverty. Its causes include lack of education, broken families, crime, addiction, mental illness, lack of planning, geographical limitations, economic shifts, and the tendency for wealth to concentrate. Each requires different solutions. True problem solving demands methodical analysis, multiple potential solutions, and careful assessment, work most find too daunting. Ideologues instead reduce problems to simple narratives with convenient villains, allowing themselves to claim moral superiority without genuine effort. Unlike religious fundamentalists who at least acknowledge something transcendent beyond their understanding, ideologues claim to possess complete truth, a fundamentally totalitarian position. This makes the ideologue more dangerous, as they consider themselves in possession of complete truth, leading to the worst excesses of pride. Ressentiment, hostile resentment, emerges when personal failure is blamed on both the system and those who succeed within it. The system is declared unjust by fiat, and the successful are branded as exploitative and corrupt. This mental framework transforms attacks on successful people into morally justified attempts at establishing justice, rather than manifestations of envy. It is morally safer to look to yourself for the errors of the world, to contemplate the log in your own eye rather than the speck in your brother's. Taking responsibility for your own imperfections is part of the messianic path, the imitation of the hero. Sophisticated understanding places the divide between good and evil inside each person rather than between groups. Like coal transformed into diamond through heat and pressure, people can be transformed through focused intensity. The diamond's qualities, purity, alignment, and brilliance, symbolize the values we should aspire to as humans. Our souls are often misaligned, with conflicting desires pulling us in different directions. We do things we wish we wouldn't and fail to do things we know we should. Graduate students at McGill University demonstrated remarkable character development throughout their challenging 5 to 6 year programs. Despite sometimes subpar courses, difficult clinical placements, and occasionally problematic supervisor relationships, these students became more articulate, disciplined, organized, and purposeful. The process of writing something long and sophisticated transformed them into more complex and deeper personalities. As a professor, Peterson observed that undergraduate psychology students who took on additional work in research labs actually achieved better grades than less burdened peers. The structure, community, and discipline required by research roles helped them use their time more efficiently. Similarly, as a clinical psychologist, he found that encouraging clients to choose the best currently available path, even if it meant temporarily lowering ambitions, led to improved mental health by substituting real action for fantasy. Commitment has enduring value, particularly in character, love, family, friendship, and career. Those unwilling to establish themselves in these domains inevitably suffer, though commitment demands sacrifice. Cynicism and nihilistic rationality easily undermine everything with questions like, why bother, or what difference will it make? But those who avoid commitment pay a high price, often drifting through life with a facade of rebelliousness or world-weary cynicism. Discipline that enables concentration begins in early childhood. Well-constituted children learn to order their instincts into cooperative and competitive strategies. By age 4, children must be sufficiently self-organized to be accepted by peers or risk permanent social ostracism. Play with peers furthers this integration. When children play games together, they subordinate competing impulses to the game's rules and goals, becoming functional parts of a larger social machine. This isn't repression of individuality, but it's development. The child learns to temper present desires with future necessities. By adolescence, such children can organize themselves into increasingly complex games, joint, goal-directed activities everyone plays voluntarily and benefits from. This ability represents civilization in its nascent form, where cooperation and competition coexist. While we may debate which specific game is best to play, we cannot reasonably argue that games themselves are unnecessary. Peterson acknowledges the irony of his famous advice to clean your room while struggling with his own disorganized office. Despite exceptional circumstances, he recognizes his moral obligation to restore order and make his space beautiful. Creating beauty, though difficult, establishes a relationship with the divine and reconnects us with the wonder of existence. Art isn't merely a luxury, but the bedrock of culture itself, the foundation that unites us psychologically. Studying art familiarizes us with civilization's collected wisdom, enriching our understanding of ourselves, others, and time itself. By inviting beauty into our lives through art that speaks to us personally, we establish a vital connection to the transcendent that helps us prevail when life's challenges become overwhelming. Peterson contrasts his childhood experience of knowing his neighborhood intimately with his adult experience of seeing without truly perceiving. As an adult, he struggles to relax and focus on the present while watching his children explore their surroundings with timeless discovery and pure joy and novelty. Though occasionally able to glimpse their pristine perspective, he was continually pulled back into concerns about future tasks. Peterson acknowledges the loss that accompanies maturity, trading rich experience and deep belonging for efficiency and order. He cites Wordsworth's poetry about the celestial light of childhood perception that fades with age, and discusses William Blake as someone who maintained this visionary perception throughout life. Blake saw beyond our memory-restricted perceptions to the unfathomable totality of the world, where everything is interconnected. Great art like Van Gogh's Irises allows us to gaze back into the eternity our perceptions once revealed, reminding us how miraculous the world truly is beneath our mundane familiarity. Peterson suggests we isolate art in museums and elaborate frames partly out of fear, to contain its transformative power and prevent it from disturbing our familiar world. Artists stand at the frontier of transforming the unknown into knowledge. They venture into the unknown and transform it into communicable images through dance, acting, painting, writing. Following artists come intellectuals with philosophy and criticism who abstract and articulate the representations and rules. Peterson distinguishes between true art and mere decoration. While many people are upset by abstract or challenging art, and some disdain tradition through artistic pretension, time ultimately separates inspired work from the fraudulent. He warns against thinking art should merely be pretty, easily appreciated, and decorative. Instead, art is exploration. Artists train people to see. Peterson explores how unresolved, painful memories persist because they represent unmapped psychological territory still deemed dangerous by our protective emotional systems. Whether we betrayed others or were betrayed, these memories evoke fear, guilt, and shame because we haven't fully understood what happened or how to prevent recurrence. Many people don't repress terrible memories so much as refuse to think them through, either pushing them away or being genuinely unable to comprehend the experience. He illustrates this through a client with hysterical epilepsy whose seizures left him emotionally unmoved. During one episode in his office, he watched impassively as she thrashed violently, eyes rolled back. His lack of concern was telling. He recognized her epilepsy as psychological rather than neurologically based. Through their work together, they addressed her sexual ambivalence, immaturity, and dramatic tendencies. Her seizures eventually stopped, and she continued her university career. Another young man came to Peterson heavily medicated on antipsychotics, barely able to speak, constantly twisting his head and shoulders in bizarre mechanical movements to make the shapes go away. His breakdown had occurred after a devastating bullying campaign at vocational college. As he worked through his memories using a structured writing exercise, he broke his life into epochs, identifying key events in each period. This process made him increasingly articulate. Recollecting his life was literally putting him back together. As he processed these memories, his psychotic symptoms dramatically receded. He became clear-headed, stopped his strange behaviors, enrolled in summer school, and completed his coursework, a near-miraculous recovery. When problems remain unresolved, they grow like hydras. One lie breeds more. One act of self-deception requires new delusions. Our destiny is to transform chaos into order. Unordered past chaos haunts us through emotional disruption. The cure isn't merely expressing emotion, but developing sophisticated causal understanding. Why was I vulnerable? How did I contribute? How must my values change to incorporate this negative experience? Writing down old, upsetting memories carefully and completely can be our salvation. Though not a couples therapist, Peterson sometimes includes partners in sessions when relationship dissatisfaction is a central issue. He recommends dedicating regular time for romance, perhaps 4 hours weekly, despite the initial awkwardness and resistance. When suggesting dates to estranged couples, he typically encounters resistance. "We dated before marriage when appropriate. Besides, we'll just fight." Peterson challenges this defeatist thinking by asking if they truly plan to never have another date in their entire married life. He encourages couples to attempt dating despite initial discomfort, without expectations of immediate success. The first attempts often go poorly, with couples proudly reporting their failure. Peterson reframes this. With potentially 3,000 romantic interludes over 30 years, twice weekly, 15 failed dates represent merely 0.5% of their potential time together. Improvement comes gradually. Perhaps the next date is 5% better, and eventually they might remember why they married. Maintaining romance requires a relationship-wide strategy founded on effective negotiation. This demands that both partners know what they need and want and discuss these desires forthrightly. Many avoid clarifying their desires to avoid confronting potential failure, but the chance of getting what you want without aiming for it is vanishingly small. Trust is essential for romance, not naive trust, but courageous trust that acknowledges the possibility of betrayal. This trust requires truth as its foundation. You cannot maintain trust in yourself if you lie or act in ways that would require lying if discovered. The vow that preserves romance is fundamentally the decision not to lie to your partner, which provides immense practical advantages when life becomes difficult. In a Scandinavian wedding ritual, the bride and groom hold a lit candle between them, symbolizing their union through a higher principle. The marriage vow, "I am not going to leave you in sickness or health," creates a situation where escape is not an option. This apparent constraint actually generates the necessary heat for transformation and maturation. Without this commitment, the suffering required for growth can be too easily avoided. The practical considerations of domestic life are foundational to romance. Without clear role definitions, couples must negotiate every detail of household management. Approximately 200 tasks comprise running a household, as complex as managing a business, but with the added challenge of doing so with family. Each responsibility must be consciously negotiated to avoid endless passive-aggressive battles that poison romance. You have understandable reasons for resentment, deceit, and arrogance when facing life's terrible forces. How might you resist declining into evil when confronted with anxiety, shame, grief, disappointment, betrayal, tyranny, and mortality? Understanding your motivations for evil provides protection against temptation. To understand how to resist evil, we must reconsider what the world is made of, not just material objects, but reality as fully experienced with all subjective richness intact. Upon awakening, you don't truly perceive the furniture and objects in your bedroom. Being already familiar with them, you perceive your surroundings psychologically, as an array of possibilities concerning the day ahead and future months and years. We perceive the world through eternal characters that structure our understanding of potential. The Dragon of Chaos represents our innate understanding of danger lurking beyond safety. This fear is neurologically embedded within us. Children's fear of darkness isn't irrational, but reflects ancient wisdom about predatory threats. Nature presents itself as both beautiful landscape and destructive force. Nature embodies both benevolence, life, beauty, fascinating experiences, and absolute horror, destruction, disease, suffering, death. These elements exist side by side, with the former requiring the latter. Even within our healthy bodies, a delicate balance between cell death and renewal sustains us. Why do we fall prey to resentment, that terrible hybrid of anger and self-pity tinged with narcissism and vengeful desire? Resentment arises because we face the absolute unknown with its terrors, nature's constant conspiracy against us, the tyrannical elements of culture, and the malevolence within ourselves and others. The real question isn't why we feel resentment, but why everyone isn't resentful about everything all the time. Deceit comes in two forms: sins of commission, things we do knowing they're wrong, and sins of omission, things we let slide. Both forms are motivated by resentment and enabled by arrogance. When we lie, we attempt to tip reality in our favor, gain an edge, or avoid punishment, often transferring that punishment to others. We sacrifice the future for the present, suffering the pangs of conscience, but stubbornly continuing nonetheless. The antidote to resentment, deceit, and arrogance is faith, not just in divine structures, but in yourself, your fellow humans, and existence itself. It means believing there's enough to you to contend with life's difficulties and transform your existence into something meaningful. Despite the fundamental uncertainty of being, despite nature's cruelty and society's tendency toward tyranny, we can still be good. After decades searching for certainty, Peterson has concluded that while suffering is inevitable, humans possess remarkable capacity to transcend it both psychologically and practically. Courageously confronting suffering provides psychological purpose that serves as an antidote to the pain itself. This confrontation reassures our deepest biological alarm systems of our competence. Beyond psychology, this noble stance allows us to work effectively to ameliorate misery.